Hi, and welcome to another episode of Adventures in Contracting. I am Leona Charles. I am the CEO and president of SPC Business Consulting, where we do all things government contracts. And today on our episode, please go ahead and subscribe and check out our other episodes on our YouTube channel, Adventures in Contracting. And you can also find us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn at SPC Consulting and Adventures in Contracting. Or you can find us at our website, www.spcconsulting.org, or you can shoot us an email at info@spcconsulting.org. So on today's episode, we are going to be discussing the granted injunction on the, and I'm probably going to butcher this, so I apologize in advance, on the News Yard versus the Minority Business Development Agency, or MBDA. So first, here's what we're going to do. First, we're going to talk about the argument that was made for this case. Then we're going to talk about each plaintiff individually. And finally, we're going to discuss the court's ruling and their rationale. So let's just dive right in. So the facts about this case are, basically, there are three white businessmen that are alleging discrimination by the MBDA. They're saying that because they're white, they were discriminated against because the MBDA is a race conscious organization and their programs are race conscious. So they're saying that due to that race consciousness, they were discriminated against and not provided services. So the MBDA requires its clients to, federal law requires MBDA to provide clients federal assistance to eligible entities who are defined as being at least 51% owned and operated. That means managing the business and managing the daily operations by someone who is socially or economically disadvantaged. Now, to MBDA, the definition of the social or economically disadvantaged individuals are protected classes, and those are Black, African American, Hispanic, Latino, American Indian, Alaskan Native, Asian, Native American, Puerto Rican, Eskimo, Hasidic Jews, Asian American, or Spanish speaking. So now these three plaintiffs claim that their discrimination is based on a violation of the Fifth Amendment, which basically states that equal protection requires that the government not draw distinctions based on individuals solely based on differences that are irrelevant to a legitimate government objective. So if you're following me, I think, or if you follow me long enough, you think I know that my objections are basically going to be around the requirement for a legitimate government objective, because I think that the government trying to address some of the discriminatory practices and some of the historically and systemic racial divide is a legitimate government objective, but you know, that's just kind of my perspective. But the question here is, how is race an irrelevant government objective, and rectifying that? So the plaintiffs are Dr. Jeffrey Newsyard. He is the owner of Sexual Wellness Centers of Texas. He claims he was denied service because he was white and was otherwise a qualified candidate for MBDA, or qualified client, rather, excuse me, for MBDA. So it wasn't clear from reading the documents how he was otherwise qualified. Because remember, you know, the requirement is that you are either socially or economically disadvantage. So I didn't get from reading the documents how he was otherwise qualified. If he wasn't in one of the protected classes, right, that have historically faced discrimination, inability to access capital, inability to find buildings, inability to practice freely, then that shoots to an economic disadvantage, where I don't see how he would have been classified. So I don't see how he would have done that. But that is his contention, is that he was otherwise qualified and he was discriminated against solely because he was a white man. The second plaintiff, Matthew Piper, owns Piper Architects in Wisconsin. Now, his claim is that he is not considered economically disadvantaged, even though he grew up in extreme poverty. So his, I find very troubling for a number of reasons. But he's saying because he grew up poor, he continues to be economically disadvantaged. And basically the argument is that because he grew up in extreme poverty, that somehow has disadvantaged him currently, which is with the previous ruling with AA, we now know that if we are going to claim economic disadvantage, we have to link it to a specific instance in which we can show that we were harmed economically by our protected status, right? So I don't understand the court's rationale here. Like, I don't understand how he's going to show these things. And I don't understand how they're interpreting it. The questions that I think are, is he in extreme poverty now? Because if he is now, then I would think that you would probably be able to show that he probably is being discriminated against. I would think that, you know, if he's in extreme poverty, he doesn't have access to traditional lines of credit. He doesn't have the ability to access funding. I think that's a stronger argument than saying, I grew up a poor white guy and that's how I'm being discriminated against. The other question I would ask is, did his extreme poverty in his youth, did it stop him from creating his business? Did it stop him from going to college? Did it stop him from growing his business? Did his extreme poverty, can you directly correlate that to him being denied business credit? How has his poverty tangibly affected him right now as his case is filed? What is his current net worth? Because if he is not extremely poor now, you could argue it's probably not affecting him. And it doesn't qualify because it's not continuously affecting him. Christian Bruckner is a Romanian immigrant who owns a project management corporation in Florida. He claims he was denied access due to his ethnicity. And his ethnicity did not qualify him as disadvantaged. And he was discriminated as he was trying to access help with, you know, government contracts. And my question then is, did he previously try to access government contracts? Why wasn't he successful, you know, thus far? What kept him from winning contracts? Was it something directly attributable to him being an immigrant? I think that would have been a much meatier stance for him to say he was discriminated because he's an immigrant versus I'm discriminated because I'm white. But that's what he went with. The preliminary injunction was granted, and here's why. And I'm going to give you a trigger warning. Some of these arguments are just flat out ridiculous, and they just really make me tired. But here we go. So the court found that on standing, Newsyard had standing because the denial of his service resulted in the inability of him to obtain the benefit. So in other words, simply because he did not get to apply, he was denied the benefit. It doesn't matter if he could have, I shouldn't say it doesn't matter, but they are not taking into account whether or not he would have gotten it regardless. They're just saying by the simple act of him not even being permitted to receive services, he was denied the benefit. He only needed to show that he was likely to apply in the foreseeable future. And the court is stating that he showed readiness because he had applied for federal assistance before. He had sought out the MBDA's benefits. He visited the website and called even after he had been told that he could not be helped due to his race. So I just want to put this in perspective that this one sentence, he did kind of like bare minimum business research. So just to put it in perspective, if you do even basic information gathering on a government agency, Through this ruling, you would be able to claim discrimination because you had just done like basic internet research, and it blows my mind. Like I don't understand how this holds water. The court also found that his injury is traceable to race and ethnicity-based programs. And this is just ridiculous. I mean, the race-conscious programs were stood up as a way to address institutional racism against particular minorities in the U.S., right? So it wasn't all minorities, but these race-conscious programs targeted the most notable minorities, if you would. And really the way that they're classified kind of covers a multitude of sins, if you will. I mean, it includes a lot of people. So the ideal then that the historical precedent for setting these up and trying to make some of these egregious historical and systematic discrimination policies right is not a legitimate government issue. I can't even like begin to wrap my head around how that happens or where you kind of find the gumption to even make that argument. The court also found that the personal injury was fairly traceable to the defendant's alleged unlawful conduct. And again, remember, they're calling unlawful conduct the race conscious program. So my response to that is, what injury? Well, the court says the denial is the injury. Okay. I say, how is that an injury when the Small Business Development Centers offer the exact same services that the MBDA does? So he could have gone to another government agency and received the very, very same services. So why did he go straight to the MBDA? I mean, I just don't, like, it's not like they were the only agency that provided these services. There was literally one, and they referred him to the Dallas-Fort Worth Business Center, which literally did the same thing. Again, I asked, how is it traceable? And they're again saying, well, it's traceable to the Race Conscious Program because that was the injury, and if not for that program, he wouldn't have a standing. So that's how they're proving it. The court found it likely, not merely speculative, that a favorable decision would redress the injury. So, in other words, the court found that by allowing him to participate in the program, it would solve the problem. Which, I mean, is crazy, but that's what they found. So here's where the MBDA messed up a little bit, in my opinion. So the race-conscious measures have to meet scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause. And part of that means that it has to target a specific episode of past discrimination, and it can't simply rely on generalized assertions. So with that, this judge, who, in my opinion, this was Judge Shopping, no doubt about it, he took that and ran with it and basically said, disparity studies and institutional racism is a generalization, right? And it needs to be pinned down to one specific instance where you can say to me that the MBDA participated in this particular situation that happened in 2001 and 170 businesses were discriminated that were black, and 200 businesses that were Asians were discriminated against, and 12 Native American businesses and 12 Native Hawaiian businesses. You know, the way that he wrote his opinion, his ruling rather, is that he wanted specific instances of discrimination to be set because this was a race conscious program. He also said that there must be evidence of past intentional discrimination, and he single-handedly pointed out disparity studies were not, in his opinion, sufficient. For some of the reasons that I just talked about, he also said that the government must have participated in said past discrimination. So not only is it not enough to say systemic racism is not a thing, institutional racism is not a thing. I need a specific instance. That particular agency had to have participated by this judge's ruling in that specific instance in order for him to grant that strict scrutiny of equal protection was met. So, I mean, that's a lot to unpack, but generally what he's saying is MBDA can't play the race card is essentially what I'm going to link it to, because that's what it sounds like to me. Another thing that he is saying is essentially that a personal injury has to be traceable, and because they have linked the race conscious program as and his denial as literally the personal injury, then therefore the state or the MBDA has the responsibility of proving how it's not and that they didn't do so. Now, what I will say that I think the judge did get right is that a lot of these centers and resources are performative in what they do. And I think that this ruling, if there is any silver lining coming out of it, and I'm sure it'll be appealed, but in the interim between the appeal, what I think the silver lining is that it will require these programs to be much more than performative. It will actually require them to show some real connection and some real outcomes. As opposed to just, hey, you know, we've seen X amount of clients and, oh yeah, we've got these 10 firms that are doing really well. It's gonna force these programs to sit back and really think about how we are helping people and how that help is attributed to something that has directly been identified as an issue within minority business communities. So another thing that I would take away is that denying someone access to a program due to race may be something that we have to figure out a way around, right? Because now I think it's an issue, and I don't think it's a good idea by any stretch of the imagination, but I kind of feel like let's do malicious compliance with this, because if now all of the trends are to kind of dismantle DEI programs and dismantle anything that's race conscious, great. So then that's actually not a bad conversation to have, because let's talk about how white businesses have issues getting credit. Let's talk about how white businesses have issues getting opportunities. Let's talk about how white businesses have issues getting into closed spaces. I think what this can do as a silver lining is it can open up a broader conversation about the challenges, about the limitations that we face, and that we are able to come back with a much more substantive argument, and an argument that has forced us to focus on the actual outcomes rather than just relying on a basic foundation. Even though we know the basic foundation is very, very irrefutably true, right? We also are noting that with this new wave of legal interpretation that seeks to be colorblind, there's going to be a trend towards race not being an adequate, or race or discrimination or institutional discrimination not being an adequate argument. I think it is going to allow us the ability to formulate an airtight argument. I mean, even though the foundational, in my opinion, argument is airtight, I think this ruling will give way to a type of malicious compliance that I don't know that these gentlemen and their conservative lawyers were looking to open that can of worms. I don't think they were quite ready for that, but I think if it's played correctly, you could do that. some of the rationale makes no sense to me, and I don't find a legal basis for it, but it is there. But I am all for the dismissal of kind of performative programs that, you know, are showing little to no growth year over year, or programs that only kind of help a certain sector of minorities or a certain type of minorities. So I'm all for holding some of these programs to the fire and saying, no, really, what are you doing? How is this helping? What are you showing? Because one of the things that the judge did point out is that it is very hard to have a program that is both over inclusive and not under inclusive. So I know that kind of seems like an oxymoron, but the way I think about it is, under inclusive, you're not including everybody, which there are pockets of the community that we are excluding. I think that's worth looking at. If we're talking about equality, I think we should always be ready to re-examine that. And are we over-including? I think that that's worth looking at too. And if we maybe adopt for the MBDA what has been adopted for the SBA, right, which is take that race piece and link it to a tangible economic detriment, then I think what we can do is dismantle some of the arguments that were put forth in this injunction. And I think that we can argue it in a way that creates a much more substantial program, assistance program for minority businesses. That is my two cents. I have talked a lot. There's a lot that I don't agree with, and I don't agree with the systematic dismantling of DEI programs. I don't think any good will come of it. And I will say this. The dismantling of DEI programs and these race-based or these race-conscious programs is not going to stop there. They're soon going to be questioning small business programs. They're going to be questioning gender programs. And so I really think when people are having discussions about this, my hope is that they are discussing what does the future look like. If they're trying to dismantle this program now based on race consciousness, what's next? And I would offer that it's going to be gender-based, and it is it's going to be size-based. They're going to start coming after, are you really a small business, and why should a small business get a set aside? And I think those are things that we need to consider as we go down these roads, particularly if you support things like this, like the dismantling of race-based programs. I think you need to think about, what would you do as a small business if size standards were no longer okay, right? If they deem size standards as a race-based program, if they use that same rationale and applied it to size standards, and now as a $500,000 a year company, you're competing with a $2 billion company. Is that fair? So I say, I don't want to kind of mix up topics, but I think it doesn't bear scrutiny when you look at it in a larger context. And I think the larger context is that they are going to not stop at race conscious programs. This is definitely going to keep going to gender programs, and it's definitely going to keep going to size programs. So love to hear your comments. Appreciate your time.